There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
The Big Question.
We're here with author, speaker and consultant Dr. James Kelly, who hosts the Executive After Hours podcast and is the author of the book we're discussing titled The Crucible's Gift, Five Lessons from Authentic Leaders Who Thrive in Adversity. The question I mentioned, how do leaders thrive in adversity, is just one of many questions that I think we'll be addressing before 12 o'clock today. So you were last with us to talk about Adam Kay's This Is Going to Hurt. So first of all, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back. It's so much fun for me to be in this environment and to listen to you.
I'm talking about your own book this time.
Well, whatever. You know, tomatoes, tomatoes. I'm just happy to...
He sounds super thrilled about it and passionate about it. Yeah, whatever. Well, so how long has this taken you, first of all? And when did you start writing it? And when did the idea for writing this come about?
So I think this is a great question because, first of all, I wrote the book in 7 weeks. So I sat down. I had a method that I used that expedited the whole entire process to where I had... Monday, Tuesday was research. Wednesday morning was outline. Wednesday afternoon was my wife interviewing me on the outline because they were question-based. Thursday and Friday was wordsmithing the chapter. And so I would go through and I would transcribe the interview and I would just do a chapter a week for 7 weeks. So the process was fast. The motivation for it came from two different streams. First, the initial stream, the book answer is I interviewed 140 executives from around the world, you know, so these were Fortune 100 all the way to individuals who are entrepreneurs and everything in between. But it was also inside me. So I had these concepts based on my own personal story of what I think certain leaders have, when certain leaders have the ability to excel in an environment, they seem to have some of these attributes that I discuss. So, oh, yeah.
I thought it was interesting when I was reading it that you'd basically, like you say, you've already done a lot of the work because, you know, your podcast was already the Executive After Hours, but it started as something else and you changed the title of it, I think, when you were halfway through. Because you started noticing some of the concepts and ideas that were in this. Was it about halfway through the process when you were interviewing people?
So the whole process started probably 2015 when I started my podcast. At the time, it was called Brave Endurance Wellness Podcast. And I was interviewing all these CEOs in the corporate wellness space. And I started hearing this theme. And about episode 50, the theme I started to hear is kind of the framework of the book at the end of the day. And so the podcast, I actually put on hiatus after the book was written because I was just spread so thin, trying to do too much. And so, so I totally shifted gears. And I think that's a lesson for writers is sometimes you have to be open to what's really in front of you and not force something into a different space.
There's one thing that I want to tackle first of all. So it's called The Crucible's Gift, Five Lessons from Authentic Leaders Who Thrive in Adversity. Adversity is an important word here. Authenticity is an important word here. And I know there's more nuance to this in the book, but the big question that I had going into it was,
yes,
aren't there successful leaders who maybe don't have this adversity or crucible moment, who don't go through something absolutely horrendous and succeed? There are people who are successful who maybe don't go through all these horrible things.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I don't think there's a one size fit all. What I found is that there's a direct proportion between the level of adversity you had and the ability to be resilient. And within that, you realize that being authentic or being your best version of yourself is the best way to live. We live in this world of polarities. We have our external self or our public self, and we have our private self. So how we act now for most of us is different than how we're going to act when we're at home with our loved ones. And what I found is that the leaders who had the best ability, the strength to align those as close as possible, it's impossible to be the exact same at home and in public, but to get as close as possible, lived in a way that they were happier and healthier. So yeah, there's successful leaders who are out there. We have one currently, not to go political, in the country of America, who I would argue has two different selves completely. And within that, there's tension in between, and that tension creates anxiety, depression, all sorts of other issues that can manifest itself. So for me, what I found is, yes, there definitely are those leaders who didn't have major adversity, but I will tell you that their self-awareness is not nearly as deep and as robust as those who have been through some sort of adversity.
The be yourself, everyone else is already taken, you know, famous quote there, which connects quite nicely. But It's great advice. And I just found myself wondering whether there are ever circumstances where it's not, because you talk about honesty in this mm-hmm. as well, and integrity and being true to who you are, mm-hmm. making you more successful in the long term. Is it always appropriate to be yourself, though? Aren't there ever situations where it could backfire?
Yeah, it's happened to me multiple times in my life. So, I mean, sure.
I'm with you there.
Yeah. So, but I always err on the side of being yourself is a better meter than being someone else, because you have to put your head on the pillow at the end of the night. Now, I will tell you that in the book, I talk about this thing called the 15% rule. Mm. And the idea of this 15% rule is the ability to turn yourself up and turn yourself down. So I use the example that when I'm on stage or I'm talking, I turn myself up a little bit more, a bit more authentic, a little bit more out there, a little bit putting on a public face. But when I'm at my in-laws' house, I turn myself down 15% because they can't handle me at full-blown myself. And so it's having that, being able to have that 30% swing is really important for authentic leaders, because they have a baseline. I just also want to preface this word authentic because, man, it is out there like fungus growing in the weeds somewhere. I don't know. It's a bad analogy, but it's the word is used everywhere. The way I like to describe it is that each of us have the best version of ourselves for ourselves. There is no one best version for everybody. And the idea of this book, even though it's about leaders, it's bigger than leaders, because all of this stuff happens outside of the work environment for us as human beings. And so the bigger premise of the book is, how can we strive to be a better version of ourselves? And so I create a framework for that. I just put the context in a leadership perspective.
What do you think about this, Yvette?
Yeah, I'm quite interested in the whole discussion about just being yourself.
Mm.
And I've always found it very hard to be anything but.
Yeah, it's exhausting,
myself.
Isn't it?
It is. And also, you're absolutely right. Sometimes it doesn't quite go right, and you realise that being yourself and yourself is not quite what people are expecting. but I think it's very hard to maintain anything other than that. Mm. And as you say, sleep comfortably at night and actually ever feel relaxed, because you have to remember who you are meant to be in different mm. situations if you're going to put on that sort of persona
yeah.
of, you know, I'm in this situation, I'm somebody else, I'm going to treat these people differently, I'm going to be a different person to what I am when I'm at home. But I love the bit about the turning up and down 15%. I think that's a perfect description of what you should be doing. So, you know, if you're going on stage to give a presentation, you almost have to write, I am now doing this, I'm in mm-hmm. a different role, mm-hmm. I can do this, but still be me.
Yeah.
But then, as you say, you know, I suspect my family may say that I never actually turned down the 15%. I've just been pondering that one.
or your authenticity is always 100%, right?
Yeah, yeah.
One of the things I talk about in the book, though, and I think you bring up a really valid point, is the ability to learn. And so that's where you go into a situation and yourself may offend or be whatever. You learn from that situation and then you adjust. You're still within yourself.
Yes.
But you adjust to the equation as it changes.
Yeah.
And that's an important part. There are some people I interviewed who did not have this growth mindset or learning mindset that I talk about. And I mean, I've got a great example. He'll never listen to this. It's an old coach of mine, right? And I go to see him recently and he literally brought up himself and his excellence 1,000 times. But he's an amazing guy, right? He's super, big, huge heart. But somehow he makes it about himself. And as soon as you make things about yourself, you start disarming the people who want to be part of the process, because it's energy sucking at some level when someone always talks about their excellence and how good they are and they wanted me in the room and blah, blah, blah. Okay, great. Like, I know you're smart. I don't need you to tell me 25 times. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So he hasn't had any like major issues in his life. So he's never had to deal with this whole idea of confronting his own personal identity and his own self-worth, because he's always been successful. This is an example of someone who's uber successful, but is not very self-aware.
Yeah. This just sounds like a very frustrating person to be around.
He's really nice. He's super helpful every time I see him, but I just don't talk.
Yeah.
Like, I know he's going to do all the talking. And there's wisdom.
Those things are all about empathy as well, aren't they?
Yeah.
And actually being able to read the people you're in the room with.
Correct.
And at some point thinking, I may be getting this wrong.
Yeah. And that's part
maybe
of the
maybe I'll stop now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, so there's a section here right in the foreword, which is because I was asking myself as well, okay, authentic leadership, important if you are trying to be a better leader, trying to be more authentic. But kind of what impact does this actually have on work environments?
Sure.
And surely it might suck like time and money out of organizations if you're focusing on well-being, but actually it's quite the opposite.
Yes.
So the statistics in the foreword, I think, is it Joe Burton.
He's a great story, by the way.
Oh, go on. Tell us about that first.
So Joe Burton wrote the foreword of my book, and Joe Burton was, at the age of 40, was a chief financial officer.
Fifth time's a charm.
Yeah. We'll get there. I'll just rub my bald head and eventually it'll come out right. He was a chief financial officer for a global advertising agency at 40. This is unheard of, like almost a $1 billion company. And he had his crucible moment. Within a 3-year period, his twin sister died, another sister died, his dad died 10 years before, but it all came colliding at one point where he was on the road all day making everyone around him miserable because he was cranky, he had a bulging disc, he was overweight, asthma, and he just thought there had to be a better way. And so he started a mindfulness practice for himself. And at first, when the doctor suggested this, he said, "There's no way I can bring this into the boardroom. I will get laughed out of the boardroom." So a year goes by and he's still miserable and he starts to do it. And what he starts to realize is in these moments of mindfulness, he is allowed to kind of dissect his past and his adversity and what it meant to him and why he was going astray and who he was trying to prove to and about what. And as he dissects it, he goes to his CEO when he's 42 and says, "You know what? I'm quitting." The CEO goes, "You are stupid. You have the best job ever now for the rest of your life." And he ends up leaving, starting his own company called Will.com, W-H-I-L.com, free advertisement, free Joe. And he ended up creating a whole online mindfulness platform that he is passionate about. He is very chilled out, much happier, healthier relationship with his wife and his kids and his family. But it took a 10-year to 15-year process for that crucible moment to crash together for him to say, okay, there's got to be a different way. So that's a great example of Joe who wrote the foreword.
Yeah, and the statistics that came up just really shocked me. And this is kind of US-based, but I'm guessing this is the same all over the world. The bottom line is the same. Stress takes a $550 billion toll on US businesses every year in the form of absenteeism, lost productivity, and healthcare costs. The Gallup organization reports less than 31% of US and Canadian employees are engaged at work and less than 17% globally.
Yeah.
And crisis and trust is mentioned as well. But study after study shows this again and again and again.
So over the last year and a half, I have a blog series like every good person should at this day and age. And
oh, thanks.
Yeah. Oh, no, we're failures.
Get on it, ladies. Okay. Get on it. And so I take a lot of academic literature and I try to distill it down to very basic knowledge of like well-being in the workplace, family life balance in the workplace based on authentic leadership and the impact it has on even leader-follower relationships. So when a follower sees the leader as authentic, they carry that to their house because they live more authentically and they carry that home to their family. And so when they're in that environment in the workplace, the hard ROI is very difficult to show for any of this stuff, right? But the reality is that you can measure productivity going up. You can measure happiness going up. You can measure stress coming down. You can measure absenteeism, change. All that stuff's measurable.
Yeah.
And the core variable ends up being authentic leadership is one example.
Now, we've spoken about the book in a bit of detail in the past few minutes, and I want to kind of move over to discussing a bit of fiction. But we're still talking about the Crucible's gift here. But basically, I was doing some research, and I really love the concept of connecting fiction with business ideas because it's becoming ever more popular now. Business Insider has released kind of the books that everyone should be reading to kind of improve how they act in the workplace. There's all sorts of business book lists that include fiction more and more and more. Now, this is literature that highlights some of the key concepts in The Crucible's Gift. And when we think about leadership books, we probably think of things like How to Win Friends and Influence People. Things like that.
Yeah.
But according to a lecturer in political economy at Stanford Graduate School of Business called Scotty McLennan, there are valuable leadership insights to be found in classics, partly because you can read about a character's inner life. So not just at the moment when they're talking about what they're doing at work, but when they go home as well, how they interact with the people around them, which is very important in your book. And he actually teaches a course called The Business World, Moral and Spiritual Inquiry Through Literature. Now, when I was looking this up, a few books that he mentioned seemed particularly relevant. So Authenticity and Legacy is something that comes up in the Crucible's Gift. So in Death of a Salesman, traveling salesman Willie Loman thinks he can control his life and his family's life by trying to force himself and his sons into jobs that really ultimately don't suit them. And the lecturer said, what if he'd let go, relied on others around him rather than trying to control everything himself, and accepted his own basic nature rather than trying to become someone he wasn't? And I remember a section in your book where you were, I don't know if this is the correct job description, but you were a guidance counselor of sorts for students.
Yeah.
And they would come in tears.
I'm like on the edge of my seat, like, where are you going with this?
She can be quite scary.
And those conversations about that you'd have with students who clearly weren't there because they wanted
to be. Correct. Oh, it's, I think one of the biggest mistakes parents make, and I'm a dad of four, so I have four kids, so I will make one of these mistakes somewhere along the way myself, is that we tend to tell our kids what they should be doing to make the most money. And as soon as you put money into any equation, you are selling short your children's own opportunity to find purpose. And I think that, you know, that book, The Death of a Salesman, is a great example of trying to shove people into boxes of what you think is best for them. And often it doesn't work. And when you start tapping the collective intelligence of the group, there is so much wisdom in the whole knowledge base of a group, the collective intelligence. And we miss that. And so I think it's really powerful when you talk about that, because the students would come in and they would be in tears in my office about not wanting to do accounting, but the dad's making them or the mom's making them, not wanting to do finance. And I'd always ask why. And they said, oh, it's always because it has the most opportunity to make money. And I'm a huge believer in this. People might think I'm full of baloney, but the idea of chasing money first, I tried it in my 20s and I was super unsuccessful. And I tried to chase it in my 30s and I'm still super unsuccessful. And now I'm in my 40s and I've given up on that hope. And I'm just chasing the thing that makes me most happy and most passionate. And I'm starting to see things crack open to opportunities. You still can be a good person and still achieve the things you want to achieve by doing that. It's not an either or, it can be an and both at the end of the day.
I think that's really important. It sort of references the book we talked about last week, actually, as well, The Conscious Parent, which is basically listen to your children. But Annabelle, I don't know whether you recall when Chris Hadfield, the astronaut, was at the festival.
I do recall.
A few years ago. And I heard him give his talk to 1,000 school children. And what he was saying initially is that he wanted to be an astronaut as a child, and he's got a picture of himself in a boxes built to look like a rocket and so on, and the colander on his head or something, you know. And his parents said, no, you can't do this. And he said, but I want to do this. And he did do it, and he proved everybody wrong because he could do it. And afterwards, Q&A time, every question was from the audience was a variation on how did you disobey your parents? How did you do this? How did you manage? What happened afterwards? So I think for a lot of children, yeah, there is that pressure to do what parents want you to do.
Yeah.
All we ever said to ours was that you have to be prepared that, oh, we've invested in you, at some point you're going to have to look after us.
Yeah.
And wipe the drool up. but you always project that onto your children. I think in some way it's very, very hard not to, and your definition of success might not be theirs.
Yeah, well, and that's totally it, right? Definition of success is malleable. It depends on the person. I want to kind of go back to the literary comment you were making earlier, because you know, fiction writing is metaphors. So there are so many, and I'm not going to pull any names out of my hat because you will prove me wrong in 5 seconds, but there are so many fictional stories that are absolutely fantastic metaphors for life. And there are so many lessons in those that we can draw from. Again, don't ask me what books those are, but there are plenty out there that I'm sure you can pull from that say, you know what, being a better person, being self-aware, self-reflective, being compassionate, there are stories out there that are fictional that if you extract those and use those in your daily life, there's a lot of power in that.
I have an example right now. We're going to be talking about a retelling of Moby Dick later, and I suppose Captain Ahab is an example of a leader who's not particularly self-aware.
Indeed.
Delusional? Yeah. Maybe delusional?
Maybe a little bit. Maybe a bit delusional. I wanted to bring up the eulogy versus resume values, because that's one of the things that really stood out for me when I was reading this. Can you tell us a bit about that?
So there's a famous columnist in the States named David Brooks, who wrote a column in, I want to say, New York Times, Washington Post, something like that,
yeah,
about having resume values versus eulogy values. So resume values is what you want to put on a piece of paper that people want to select you for, right?
Yeah.
But eulogy values are how you want people to remember you. And so one of the exercises I have people go through is write their own eulogy. Write your own eulogy. Find out how you want to be seen when you're at your funeral, when you're a ghost floating around. Like, that's a very powerful tool and metaphor for your life. Often we don't think about that far ahead because we're in the now. Some of us just trying to pay a bill, eat some food. But when you start thinking about how you want to be seen, and if you want to take it a step further, ask people around you, how would you write my eulogy? And if they don't use pleasant terms, that might tell you something about yourself at the end of the day. So I think that's a really important lesson about doing things to tick a box and doing things to be a good person, be remembered as a legacy down the road.
And when you did this, how did you want to be remembered?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. So I think my whole stick in life for myself is that I want to be as good a person as I could be today, but better tomorrow if at all possible. But that's my strive. And there's days you fall back. There's days you come up short. But the idea is that, you know, one of the concepts I talk about in the book is this idea called micro moments of meaning. And what that's really about is that when I have an interaction that's whether it's 15 seconds or we're done here, I want to leave you with some sort of smile on your face. So if I can create that positive marker as a neuron in your brain, next time you see me, you'll remember that. And so it's not hard to do. It just means being present and thinking about the other person and engaging with them. And so if I can do that over time, whether I have 1% at my funeral or I have 1,000, you know, then in my mind, I've done the best I could do to do that.
Top tip, if you want to leave us with a smile on our face in future, bring snacks. Super easy.
But not into the studio.
Yes, yes, no. I can't bring it in the funeral. The studio.
No, I'm sorry. Yeah.
No. Not into the studio, yeah. But for later.
Yeah.
There we go. One more book that I wanted to reference. We've got a couple of minutes. So Compassion and Balance, I suppose this would come under. Remains of the Day by Kazuo Ishiguro was highlighted by a number of similar listicles when I was looking about connections between literature and business ideals. And it's about an elderly butler who's so devoted to his work that he's blinded to everything else around him. And it's a novel that's often referred to in writing about leadership and ethics particularly. And that's something that you highlight as important in The Crucible's gift, that to be authentic as a leader of anything, it's a process that's not just confined to the workspace. It's throughout your whole life, isn't it? But to anybody listening, that might sound like a huge task. It feels almost like you have to overhaul your life.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the case?
Well, I mean, if you're totally dysfunctional and feel like you're living an inauthentic life, then yes. But most of us have a version of our authentic self somewhere along the way. And it's figuring out how to tap into that. I can't tell you how many people I've met across this journey in just my own little world who have said to me, once I stopped trying to act how people wanted me to be and started acting like I wanted to be, my world opened up.
And everything maybe sort of fell into place.
Yeah. You shed the people who are bringing you down and you go to the people who are lifting you up. And when you get to those places, it's such a better place to live spiritually, metaphorically, like any way you want to think about it, it's a positive term. It's just a much better place to be. And so, you know, I want to state this again. The book is so much more than just about leadership because, you know, in the book I have an equation that I talk about plus or minuses and things like that and changes. But at the end of the day, there's an infinity symbol that goes through this equation. So for any of the math nerds out there who love math, I wanted to give you an equation that you can think logically about. And the infinity symbol really is about saying it never stops. And that's why the learning chapter is the last chapter in the book, because at the end of the day, being self-awareness, having compassion, integrity, and relating to others doesn't matter if you're not willing to learn as you go through the process, because that inevitably is what life is all about, is learning and growing. And I have a kind of a stark phrase that if you're not learning, you're dying. That's kind of my theory in life.
Okay, there's one more thing that I want to talk about.
Yes.
Very briefly, because we're running out of time.
Okay, I'll go quick.
And that's public versus private self. Because that came up and it's super important now, especially with my generation and newer generations, is because of social media. It's very hard kind of separating work and private. They're kind of melding into
Correct.
One now anyway. And The Great Gatsby came up a few times when I was researching this, but another Fitzgerald book caught my eye, and that's The Last Tycoon. And it's about a Hollywood mogul who basically he's staggeringly successful in public but failing in his private life. Mm-hmm. And when he talked about this with his students, the lecturer, they were very split on the idea that to do the job that he needed to do, he had to act that way.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them thought that if he'd had a more balanced life, he would have been successful in both areas.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that that work-life split is 100% like necessary?
So let me throw a question back to you. Do you, regardless of his acting ability, do you like George Clooney?
Yeah.
As a person?
I've never met him.
But I mean, he comes across as an affable.
He comes across as affable, yeah. Yes.
Right? And then you have other actors who come across as pretentious and uptight. Which one would you rather spend time with?
Yeah, absolutely.
And by all accounts, by all accounts, he and people who've met him and you read about whatever, not that I've met him, he's a really down-to-earth person. There are leaders like that as well. So yeah, you can have both, but then what's the result for you? What's the outcome for you as that leader? How exhausting is that for you? You see people who get instant fame, who thought it would be amazing, who then are miserable. So you can. I don't know why you would want to separate the two. Again, I don't think you have to have full disclosure. I mean, I think social media does a great job on its own, but you don't have to have full disclosure in the workplace. There is too much information moments, for sure. So yeah.
We haven't told anybody where they can buy it.
Just through Annabelle. That's it. I'm just kidding.
No. I'll get all these random messages. Yeah.
So you can get the book on Amazon, UK site, American site, either one of those. You can get it on Barnes. All the digital outlets, you essentially can get it outside of the UAE. There's a digital version. And an audio version will be coming out in December, I believe, is when that's coming out. So I record next week for that.
Oh, so it's not George Clooney?
It's not George Clooney. Look alike, but not him.
Okay, yeah. Fair enough.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.